Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Nutrition is one area of health where myths and misunderstanding abound and where facts are often denied. Today, we'll discuss vitamins, supplements, energy drinks, and more with Dr. Marion Nissel, the Paulette Goddard Professor of the Department in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. Her degrees include a PhD in molecular biology and an MPH in public health nutrition, both from the University of California, Berkeley. She's the author of three prize-winning books, Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, Safe Food, The Politics of Food Safety, and What to Eat. She also writes a monthly column called Food Matters for the San Francisco Chronicle and blogs daily at foodpolitics.com and at the Atlantic Food Channel. Dr. Nissel, welcome to Line One.
Oh, glad to be here.
Let me remind our listeners, if you've got questions or comments today, there's two ways you can reach us. You can call us at 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And you can also email us at lineone, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. I can't help but start by asking how somebody who had a PhD in molecular biology got so interested in nutrition.
Well, it got handed to me. I was teaching at an undergraduate college, and I was teaching cell biology. And the rule in my department was that if you taught the same class 3 years in a row, you had to switch. And it was, and you had to do whatever was needed, and was needed. What was needed was a class in nutrition. So it was my turn. I got it. And it was like falling in love. Uh-huh. I just loved it. And I've never looked back.
What was it about nutrition that was so so captivating?
Well, if you're a molecular biologist and you go to parties and people ask you what you do and you try to explain it, their eyes glaze over. And it was just no fun at all. And trying to teach something that was as abstract as cell biology is, where you can't really see it or taste it or feel it, it was hard teaching. And nutrition and food turn out to be the easiest things in the world to teach. Anybody can read the papers and understand them. Anybody can bring their own personal experience to bear on anything that you're talking about. It just made for really exciting biology teaching, and I just loved it.
Was there something specifically about your background you think that may have helped you immensely in the nutrition circles?
Oh, yeah, I love to eat. I really adore food. And so I had this sort of natural affinity for it. And then I was curious about the kinds of things that were in the popular media. Now, we're talking 30 years ago, now 40 years ago. Linus Pauling had just come out with a book about vitamin C and the common cold. I wondered if there was anything to it. Frances Moore Lappe came out with her book Diet for a Small Planet, where she was arguing that if you combined plant proteins, the protein was as good as it would be if it came from meat. I wondered if that were true. And I could bring my molecular biology training to asking those questions and answering those questions because I knew how to do the research. And so that's what I've done. I went from there to teach a nutrition at a medical school and from there to the government to do a big federal report on diet and health. And then I've been in NYU for the last 20 years teaching and writing about food and nutrition.
The vitamin C hypothesis that Linus put out, Dr. Pauling put out, still permeates my business. I hear people regularly throughout the winter. What's the story? You want to give us the short answer on that one?
It's one of the best placebos ever invented. And that's actually been studied. There was a study of vitamin C and the common cold done at NIH in which it was very, very clear from the results that it just had a profound placebo effect because people who thought they were taking vitamin C had fewer colds and less severe colds than people who thought they were taking the placebo, and it didn't matter which they were really taking. If you think you're taking vitamin C for a cold, it makes you feel better.
Right.
I'm a big believer in placebo effects.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge issue in much research. I mean, as much as 20-30% of the effects in certain studies are shown to be placebo effects, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I think the placebo effect should be used. And, you know, as a physician, you must use it in your practice one way or another. Just going to a doctor is
right.
a placebo.
Right.
You know, it really has an enormous healing effect, and I think we should take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. But not think it's science.
Right. And perhaps, if you don't mind, clarify for sure what we mean by the placebo effect while we're on this topic.
Well, actually, the vitamin C study was a very, very good example. What these people at NIH did was to give several hundred people vitamin C and several hundred people a placebo and ask them to count the number of days that they were sick and to... and how severe the colds were. And what they noticed during the clinical trial was that a lot of people dropped out. And they were very good investigators, so they asked the people who dropped out why they had dropped out. And it turned out that they tasted the pills, and they knew which ones they were taking, or they thought they knew which ones they were taking. So then they went back and reanalyzed the data. And it turned out that the people who had fewer colds and less severe symptoms thought they were taking vitamin C, whether or not they really were. That's the placebo effect.
So it's the sometimes beneficial effect that your mind, I guess it's fair to say, layers on how we feel. So if I go to a doctor, I already have an expectation I'm going to feel better by the end, and that's somewhat, not everybody would have that feeling, by the way, but many do. So that's the placebo effect you're talking about. And so if people think they're getting a active ingredient, they're more likely to say, I feel better.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a placebo responder. I already know that. And so if I'm not feeling well, I take an aspirin or something. I always feel a lot better.
Right. What is the principle?
Even if you know it's a placebo, it sometimes works.
Right, right. I heard a wonderful, speaking of this, that there's a website or a podcast called Skeptoid.com done by a guy named Brian Dunning, and he gave the best, 10-minute discussion of pros and cons, different kinds of placebos, what works, what doesn't, how they compare with each other, that I've really ever heard. Very succinct, and it's a wonderful little short information. What are the principal problems with our diet? Let's get to the big nutrition issues. What are we doing wrong in this country, if anything?
Oh, it's really easy, eating too much.
Right, okay.
Supersedes any other nutritional problem that you can hardly talk about anything else without talking about obesity, because it's such an enormous health problem in this country. People eat too much.
So why do we eat too much? Why do we eat too much?
I think we eat too much because too much food is produced, and it's cheap, and it's widely available, and it's heavily marketed. And society has changed in the last 25 years or so to make it acceptable for people to eat in ways that never used to be acceptable. I mean, the best example I could think of is eating in bookstores. When did it become okay to eat in bookstores? I can remember when you got thrown out of bookstores if you were carrying a cup of coffee around with you.
Mm-hmm.
So the basis of it is overproduction and overavailability of food. We produce or have available in the United States, and this includes Alaska, about roughly twice as much food available as anybody needs or could possibly use. And so the food companies have to sell that.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that by making it more widely available and by making it socially acceptable for people to eat in places they never used to be able to eat in, and to eat all day long and to eat junk foods that are heavily advertised and full of calories.
And
large portions. I mean, everybody falls for
right.
larger portions.
Right.
Everybody eats more calories if they've got
more
food in front of them than they want. Everybody does.
The other side of the coin that we've discussed here, which is also an important one, is it seems like we've also began to use less energy in our daily lives, and that combination of more energy in and less energy out has really got us in trouble. But how come, why is it if all people have so much access, we still have those individuals who are able to maintain a very healthy weight? Are they more active or they eat less, combination of both?
Well, it could be all of that, or it could be that they're just genetically lucky. Uh-huh. But the business about activity is interesting because there's very little evidence that people are less active now than they were 25 years ago.
Okay.
Very, very little evidence. In fact, there's some evidence that they're more active. And you know, the evidence isn't very strong one way or the other. But there's no question at all that people are eating more.
Okay.
Every single way of examining whether people, how much people eat, show that more calories are consumed per capita now than they were 25 years ago. You know, the exact number is, can be argued about, but people are eating more now.
Staying on this idea of energy in and energy out, and I appreciate your comment about that perhaps we do not have as much evidence that we're less active than we used to be, is intuitively, as that sounds like it's possible, I can buy it, and I appreciate it, and I believe it. When we talk to people about diets in my office, and I'm sure most physicians, we always hear the response back, well, I'm going to exercise more to lose weight. Is that a correct response from patients?
Well, I'm greatly in favor of more physical activity, so don't get me wrong
right.
about that.
I hear, yep.
But you cannot possibly exercise enough to make up for the excess calories unless you're a marathon runner, a cross-country skier, or one of these people who rides sled dogs, you know, for hundreds of miles. If you're eating a normal amount of food, you can't work it off because my rule of thumb, ballpark figure, is it's 100 calories a mile. If you want to work off 100 calories, you have to walk or run a mile. Well, a 20-ounce soft drink is almost 300 calories. That means for every 20-ounce soft drink you've got 3 miles of walking or running to do. Most people aren't going to do that much.
Right, right. So the answer is take in less.
I think that's it's much easier to lose weight by eating
right.
less.
Right.
Although
consistently.
Moving more is helpful.
Yeah.
But eating less is absolutely essential.
Yeah, and I always I try to tell the patients it's got to be done consistently. We got overweight by consistently eating more than we're burning off, so you've got to be very, very consistent about it over a long period of time.
Well, I think one of the misunderstandings is that it's overeating by a little that puts on weight. It's not overeating by a little. It's overeating by a lot every day. It's hundreds of calories extra every day. And you get used to eating that amount of food, and you think you have to starve yourself to death to lose weight. But that's because people have gotten so used to eating so much.
Let me remind our listeners, if you've got questions or comments, you can email us at line1@kska.org. You can give us a call, 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Is there anything we're eating too little of?
Well, fruits and vegetables, plant foods,
okay.
And real foods rather than processed foods. I mean, my advice is always eat less, move more, eat plenty of fruits, vegetables, and grains, and don't eat too much junk food. And you do that, and you'll do just fine. Dietary advice isn't any more complicated than that. But it's the idea that the food has to come in a package, I think, that has gotten a lot of us in trouble.
How so?
Well, because that's where all the calories are. You know, if you're going to pick up a bag of potato chips, that's going to have a lot of calories in it,
mm-hmm.
unless you just eat one, which nobody does.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that foods have to be processed, or that those, of course, are the foods that are heavily advertised. So they're the ones you hear about, and so it seems reasonable and normal to be eating a lot of packaged foods. But they're salty, they're sugary, everybody loves the way they taste. And you just don't think about the calories in them.
So what we're, in a sense, being oversold by business, which is their job is to try to market these products, is the too many calories packaged too attractively and too calorically dense.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And all of this is a result of the fact that we produce about twice as many calories per day per capita as the country actually needs. The amount of food available in the United States is about 3,900 calories per capita per day, and most people need about 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are ballpark figures. But even if a lot of that 3,900 is wasted, it's still a big excess, and what that does is make the food industry enormously competitive for selling its foods. And so they have found all of these ways to make food more available in more places in larger amounts. And that's what has gotten everybody in trouble.
We have a caller. I want to take Robert's question now, if you don't mind. Robert, you're on line one.
Yes. Hello. Well, I want first to recommend Weight Watchers, which I've been attending and lost 40 pounds and plan on keeping it off by going. And one thing, they don't use the word diet. They refer to an eating program or sense eating or something like that. But the word diet has got a bad name, and it also sounds temporary, whereas what you really need to do is change your outlook and practices with food permanently.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. I also had a question. I'm even thinking of going to a nutritionist because I once had a doctor who said to me that he ate a lot of beans and rice, and that was a wonderful diet that supplied a great deal of what he needed nutritionally, and he didn't put on weight.
That makes sense if you don't have too much oil in it, because those are relatively low-calorie foods, which, when eaten together, have plenty of protein. And that's probably what he was talking about. That was the underlying thesis of Francis Moore Lappe's Diet for a Small Planet 30 or 40 years ago. Precisely your point.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Robert.
Thanks, Dr. Woodard.
You bet. Another issue in the nutrition realm is that there's something perhaps toxic. I'm not sure that's the right word, but in what we eat. And so I scripted the following question and would like your opinion. I said, if we remove overnutrition, what we've just been talking about, eating too many calories, and we control for exercise, tobacco, and alcohol, is there really good science suggesting that our diet is toxic or harmful or contributes otherwise to significant health problems for us? And if so, what are we talking about that does that?
Well, the only thing I could think of is salt, where salt is a factor in the development of high blood pressure. And as we have an aging population, high blood pressure becomes more and more of a problem. All of the, I mean, if you're not eating any fruits and vegetables and your diet is very high in saturated fat, it can raise your risk for heart disease. But all of those kinds of dietary problems are made much, much worse by being overweight and eating too many calories. If your caloric intake is well balanced and you're not gaining weight and you're holding your own and you're being physically active, what you eat doesn't matter nearly as much as how much you eat, except for salt.
Yeah.
And maybe saturated fat, although the evidence on that is very much compounded by and confounded by body weight.
Now, that's
It's very hard to separate calories from the way that from where the calories come from.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's interesting. I read something just recently criticizing, I think it's New York City's apparent approach to trans fats being, I don't want to misquote things. Was there some legislation trying to get trans fats out of?
Yeah, they've been banned in restaurants in New York City. Or oils that have been hydrogenated are banned.
And your thoughts
in
on that?
Well, there's some evidence that oils containing trans fats are worse for raising blood cholesterol levels than even saturated fat. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that the city was able to do to address the heart disease problem. It has nothing to do with obesity.
Okay.
It's only targeted at heart disease. And I thought it was an easy call because hydrogenated oils don't taste any different than unhydrogenated oils. There are plenty of substitutes in frying oils, and it doesn't make any difference to taste, flavor, texture, or anything else. In fact, most of the restaurants that were using hydrogenated oils didn't even know the difference. They weren't doing it deliberately. Mm-hmm. They didn't even know. They were just using them because they were a little bit cheaper. They weren't even that much cheaper. So it was a very easy thing for the health department to do, to change the frying oils in the city without causing a revolution. It actually didn't cause much fuss at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess what I was reading, some comments about that, it was addressed to the idea that it would have no effect on weight gain because a fat is a fat is a fat, and it's got X amount of calories. So, but that wasn't the issue. Yeah.
No, it wasn't designed to deal with obesity. It was designed, or weight gain, it was designed to deal with heart disease risk.
Okay.
Whether it will make any difference in overall heart disease rates in New York City, we don't know.
Right.
We'll find out.
There has been, and it was recently, a review of the salt literature, which it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, which made a very, very big cost savings if we could control salt a little bit better.
Yeah, I think it would be enormous savings. And I mean, the idea is that almost everybody would do better with blood pressure if there were less salt in the diet. So that's a big factor. And I think it's a place where there's going to be a lot of push from health agencies in the next few years to try to do something about that.
Why? We talked about the placebo effect of vitamin C, and I think I would say the same thing about echinacea to a large degree. Why do these ideas hang on? Why are they hard to change? Why are there so many misunderstandings and myths, particularly in nutrition? Is there something about food that we have some innate belief is all powerful? And
people get sick, and the first thing you think of is food is something that you put in your body.
Right.
So it's extremely personal. Nothing is more personal. And so there you are, you're taking in all of these substances, you don't know where they come from, you didn't grow them yourself, you don't really know very much about them, and there are lots and lots of belief systems about food and health that have been handed down through the generations, I mean long cultural traditions about food, very difficult to change. And then you find that if you eat something, it makes you feel better, and you believe that it makes you feel better, and whether science can show it or not, you're going to keep on believing that. So people have very, very strong belief systems, almost religious, about many aspects of the food that they eat, and I don't ever try to argue with people about those kinds of beliefs. It doesn't do any good. And if it's not harmful, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter.
Let's take another caller. We got a caller from Homer, Alaska, several miles, 100 miles away from us. Amy, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I have a question about oils. Since the nutritional value is the same, I had a question. Are there certain oils that are better for children than others? Let's say olive oil versus salmon oil versus canola oil versus, you name it. And is there one that's the best or better for feeding to children?
Okay, good question.
I wrote about this in my book, What to Eat, and it has a chapter on It has a chapter on fats and oils, and you might want to take a look at it at some point because there's a lot of chemistry involved, and all oils have the same number of calories, about 120 per tablespoon, and they differ in their fatty acid composition. Some are more saturated, unsaturated, or polyunsaturated than others, but all of them are mixtures of all three. So the differences are somewhat subtle. What you're looking for is to have a lower amount of saturated fatty acid and either a higher amount of unsaturated or polyunsaturated. And so those would be the vegetable oils. Salmon oil would be a very good one. Canola oil is particularly good. Olive oil is particularly good. But the others aren't bad.
So one way...
The differences are rather subtle. Some have more of... And then there's the whole omega-3 and omega-6 business, and for that, fish oil would be useful for the omega-3s.
So for children, as Amy was asking, then there's really, is it fair to say there's the vegetable source and the animal sources, where the animal source is having more of the saturated fats, and that in general we're thinking that the vegetable fish oils are a better deal?
Yeah, I mean, salmon is really a great food. Mm-hmm. And Alaska's a very good source of salmon. You probably know that.
I love salmon. Yeah, hopefully it does something for me. Good. All right, Elaine, you're on line one. Elaine, what can we do for you?
Hi, it's just more of a comment that I wanted to make, and I'll just briefly discuss my comment. In 2006, I became very, very sick with polyarthritides. It was probably no more than 10 to 12 joints at one time, just having severe joint pain and swelling all throughout the body on both sides. And I had just had my daughter. She was 6 months old, so I thought it was something with nursing. So I was getting ready to wean my daughter anyway and slowly weaned her. And by 4 or 5 months later, I was getting to a point where I could hardly walk. And my wonderful doctor, she told me, she through my blood work, she thought I had lupus, but she couldn't make that official diagnosis because she wasn't a rheumatologist. The rheumatologist that I had at that time, she did diagnose me with lupus, and right away wanted to put me on 4 very hardcore medications. And I'm a physical therapist, so I see quite a bit some of the side effects and the deleterious side effects of medications. So I didn't want to quite go that route. So pretty much for 3 years, I had a lot of pain that I was able to sort of keep in control with a certain drug. And then my wonderful doctor, she in 2008 made a suggestion of cutting out sugar and just see what happens. And with it, placebo or not, within 72 hours, within 3 days, I was able to shovel snow. I was able to function at a pain level of maybe 2 out of 10 versus pretty much every day was 7 to 8 out of 10. So since 2008, I've been experimenting with diet, and what I have found for me, and I know lupus is different for every single person, but what has worked tremendously for me and a number of my patients that do have chronic pain is if they do make diet modifications, one modification at a time. But the biggest things just really seem to be sugar, and it was really all forms of sugar that I took out, lactose, fructose, and sugars, you know, table sugar, and pretty much all the processed foods, and then also wheat. I've taken that out, and that has helped significantly with the joint stiffness and painful swallowing. So I feel a whole lot better following kind of what I call an acronym, GOGO, like anything you can get from a garden or an orchard or a grove or the ocean. Whether it's a placebo or not, I cannot believe how much better I feel by making those diet changes. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Okay, hold on. We'll ask Dr. Nessel's opinion or thoughts.
Thank you.
Dr. Nessel, you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I just think it's wonderful that she found something that works for her. And, you know, I can't explain it. I don't have an explanation for it, but I think it's terrific that she's pain-free or down to a tolerable level. Good for you. Keep it up.
Thank you. Yeah, it's hard because everywhere you do turn, there's you know, foods are advertised and they're pushed, and we just live in a society. It's difficult to eat well. And I thought I ate well before, but I didn't realize how much sugar I had been eating and how we get kind of stuck in a routine. We kind of end up eating the same things, and we kind of lose that variety, I think, because it's just so much more convenient to just pull something out of the freezer and throw it in the microwave, and it really doesn't pay off. I think you really do have to kind of put the work in and take the time to eat right.
Thanks for your call.
Sounds like great advice to me.
Thank you. You guys take care.
Yep. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. You can reach us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@kska.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails and talk with Dr. Marion Nessel at Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Marion Nessel. She's the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. She's written extensively about food politics and been involved in some attempts at decision-making and legislation regarding that. And if you've got questions or comments, please email us at line1@kska.org. You can call us at 550-8433, and you can reach us, if you're outside of Anchorage, on a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. My usual warning, if you're listening between 8 and 9 Anchorage time, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we would not be able to answer your questions at that time. Dr. Nessel, I was a little surprised you didn't comment about the Amy's call, our last caller, about taking less sugar. To me, I'm not sure what that means. We have to have a certain amount of carbohydrate. I assume she's meaning processed sugars. You can't live without some sugar. What are your thoughts? Why didn't you say something?
Well, I did. I said I had no explanation for it.
Okay.
And that was as far as I wanted to go. First of all, okay. I don't comment on... I'm not a medical doctor.
Okay.
And I don't comment on people's illnesses. She's obviously seeing a physician who has been able to help her.
Yep.
And I can't do anything but applaud that. I mean, this is somebody who was in really terrible pain. And if I don't have a scientific explanation for it, it doesn't do anything to help her in this case. She's being helped. That's as far as I want to go on that. I can't think of any reason at all why eating sugar would affect pain in any way at all. In fact, a lot of people feel better if they eat sugar and their pain goes down. And you need a certain number of grams of carbohydrate a day. If you don't get them, then the body breaks down protein and fat in order to pull what little carbohydrate there is out of protein and fat. So I can't explain it. But she's had a result that's really an important result, and I would just advise her to keep doing it.
No, the scientist in me it wants to understand what exactly the change was. Was it, you know, Amy seemed to be open-minded to the possibility of, I don't think it's necessarily a placebo effect, but something changed, whether the natural history of whatever was causing arthritis changed, the diagnosis was wrong, but something dramatically changed.
Well, I couldn't. I couldn't tell whether she had made several changes at once because she also said that she had cut down on wheat. Now, if she had a wheat allergy, that would, you know, that would account for some of her symptoms, I'm sure.
Right, and wheat.
But it's just hard to know, and I'm not her physician, and I'm not her nutritionist, and I just didn't want to get into it.
Okay, all right. We do have a caller from Peter. He has a question about vitamin D. It's a topic I wanted to get into anyway. So let's see what Peter wants to ask. Peter, you're on line one.
Hi. Yeah, the vitamin du jour is vitamin D, and I wondered if your guest had a comment about that. As Alaskans, we get currently there's so much literature about, you know, seasonal affective depression, et cetera, and vitamin D shortage.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot. Allergy, multiple sclerosis. There's a huge number of issues associated, perhaps, with vitamin D. Tell us the vitamin D story, Dr. Nelson.
Well, it's a complicated story. It's not a vitamin, first of all. It's a hormone.
Right.
And it's a hormone that's synthesized in a multi-step process from the effect of sunlight on skin. Now, the last time I was in Alaska, it was in mid-June, and it was light practically. I was in Fairbanks. It was light practically 24 hours a day. You're not going to have seasonal affective disorder in the middle of June. The winter is another matter. But, you know, I think that people evolved to store up enough of the storage form of the vitamin so that they can get through the winter, but a lot of people think that isn't enough. And part of the evidence for thinking that it isn't enough has to do with the way in which vitamin D is measured in the body. As I said, it's a multi-step process, and the assay measures one of the intermediate steps. And I just don't know what that means. To have a result, if that intermediate is low, that doesn't necessarily mean that the storage form is low, or that the active hormone is low. It's just hard to know what it means, but because that intermediate is often low, and many people have many symptoms of diseases that are associated with vitamin D in one way or another, lots of people think that you need to take far more. Then I think makes sense evolutionarily. Although in Alaska, I'm not sure. I mean, the rule in temperate zones is that if you're out 15 minutes a day with your face exposed to the sun, you're supposed to be getting enough. I don't know what happens in Alaska. You probably need more.
Yeah. Peter, did that answer your question?
Yeah, other than what about, is blood testing worthwhile doing?
I don't know the answer to that question.
I mean,
I really don't.
Yeah. I mean, that's currently what's recommended. And I guess I'm somewhat skeptical, as I hear Dr. Nessel say, is because so many people have been found to be low based on this assay, including skateboarders in Hawaii, that it begs the question of what are we really measuring and looking at?
You know, I take a one a day. I would do that, I think. If you have any concern about it at all, take a one a day vitamin supplement that has 400 units of vitamin D, and the chances are it'll be just fine. The Institute of Medicine is coming out with a big report on this any day now. That I think will make recommendations about standards, and I'm very much looking forward to what that scientific committee comes up with.
All right, thank you.
You bet. It's an important question, and we look forward. I agree. Hopefully we'll have that information pretty shortly. Let's go ahead and take another phone call. Heather, you're on line one.
Hello.
Hello, yep. What can we do for you, Heather?
I have a question for your guest, and appreciate very much her coming on. I'm trained in animal nutrition, and I am interested in knowing if she might know, in terms of requiring nutrition to be part of the curriculum of a medical doctor, is that something that's standard now across the country? And if it is, great, and if it isn't, why not?
You know, my latest book is called Feed Your Pet Right, and it's just come out within the last couple of weeks. And we have a whole chapter in that. I wrote it with a co-author, Dr. Malden Nesheim, who's an trained in animal nutrition at Cornell, and we have a whole chapter on veterinary nutrition training and whether pet food companies influence veterinary nutrition and training. And we were astounded at how little nutrition training there is of veterinarians. There's a very good explanation for that, and that is that the pet food industry has been so successful in developing products for dogs and cats that are complete and balanced and meet all of their nutritional needs in one product, that veterinarians don't need to know anything. All they have to do is just recommend one of these products, and they've taken care of it for the most part. We don't think that's such a great idea. We think they need much better nutrition training. And there is a section of the veterinary profession that specializes in nutrition, but something like under 100 of the 75,000 licensed veterinarians in the United States have that training. So you're pretty lucky. You're pretty lucky if you find one that does.
I appreciate that. I'm also wanting to know, in terms of human medicine, is that a requirement? Because it seems to me, in my experiencing doctors, that they're very ill-trained in that regard. They know pharmacy, but they don't know the biological, you know, ingredients of food and how valuable it is, raw food.
Yeah, I taught nutrition for 10 years at a medical school, and I can tell you that very, very few medical schools do any kind of nutrition training at all, in part because nutrition counseling isn't reimbursable by insurance companies. So as long as we have a healthcare system that's focused on treatment and not prevention, I don't think there's ever going to be any pressure for them to learn anything. But you're absolutely right. Very, very few doctors are trained in nutrition.
Can I ask you another question about enzymes?
Sure.
You can ask.
I'm understanding that enzymes are the short chain proteins that actually are like the key to the lock that fuel that actually catalyze so many reactions in the body that are valuable. And I'm wanting to know, when you have a processed food of any kind, heat treated or otherwise, are you missing those enzymes, and does your body then have to build them out of its storage house?
Enzymes are proteins, and yes, they catalyze biochemical reactions in the body, but you make them yourself. The processing
of from your food, is it less taxing
to
your body?
You don't get enzymes from food. You don't get enzymes from food. You make them yourself out of the nutrients in food. And as long as your nutritional intake is adequate, you're going to be able to make all the enzymes you need.
Well, I'm taking food enzymes in a supplement.
Oh. Why?
Because I'm told that that is valuable in terms of the amount of processed foods we have, and that our diet is not enough fresh, raw ingredients.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any kind of supplement that will aid the way enzymes work in the body, in part because whatever the proteins are, they're going to be inactivated in the stomach by the very, very strong acid that's in the stomach. That's going to inactivate any proteins that are brought into the body. And when they get into the intestine after leaving the stomach, digestive enzymes are going to digest them. So I don't exactly understand the point of this. But again, if it makes you feel better, keep taking them.
Well, I'm just trained by animal nutritionists to make sure that the diet for my animals has food enzymes that are supplied outside, you know, the diet.
Well, I would say that's the same is true of dogs and cats. They make their own enzymes. And they also have acid in their stomach and enzymes in their digestive tract that will digest any foreign proteins that come in. So I find it very difficult to believe that they would work.
Okay.
Thanks for your call, Heather. All right, let's take another call. Peggy Allen, you're on line one.
Okay. I have a question for Dr. Nessel. If you have any suggestions about policy changes that might be most effective in dealing with the problems of overproduction of food in the U.S., if there's things that could be tweaked politically that might have a larger effect that we should.
Yeah, this one's going to take more than a tweaking. I mean, what you're asking about is the farm bill, which comes up about every 5 years or so. The last one was a couple of years ago. And the farm bill governs everything in agricultural policy. And the most obvious thing, piece of it to talk about is the subsidies for corn and soybeans. Corn and soybeans are the basis of a great deal of processed food. They're subsidized. They reduce the cost of processed foods, and they reduce the cost of animal feed, so that meat is also cheaper than it would be if they had to pay full price for animal feed. And a lot of people are thinking that we really ought to have a farm policy that supports sustainable agriculture and that supports fruits and vegetables. That's going to take more than a tweaking, because as long as our election campaigns start in Iowa and other farm states, those states are going to argue very strongly against any changes in that. And that has what has happened year after year after year with the Farm Bill. Get involved with the Farm Bill. It's a really interesting document. The last one was 1,200 pages long and had a table of contents that was 17 pages long. And you have to do it little bit by little bit and pick a piece of it that you think is important and work on it. I'd like to see much, much, much more effort made to support sustainable agriculture, which I've seen in Alaska. It's pretty impressive.
Is the American Medical Association at all involved in lobbying for changes in the Farm Bill?
I doubt it. I don't see why they would be. It's a little bit out of there. It's a little bit out of it. The people who are really involved in the Farm Bill lobbying are the big agricultural producers. I mean, this is
but
big
agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's unfortunate about it is that the farm policy is not linked to public health policy. It should be. And so starting in the last Farm Bill, there was a huge effort made by grassroots political advocacy groups to try to link agricultural policy to health policy, but it didn't get very far.
I see.
I mean, there were a few things that were done to support organic production, but very little. And right now we're subsidizing corn and soybeans at the, you know, at a level of $20 billion a year.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your call. All right, we've got about 10 minutes left. I've got a number of people with phone calls and a couple of emails, but there's a couple of issues I want to get to, and we may not get to all of our calls. The two big issues in my mind that we hear a lot about that I'd like your expertise on. One is organic foods. Do they taste better? Are they safer? Are they better for us? Are they worth the extra cost? And the other is what I wrote is, what is the skinny on the high fructose corn syrup? Is it just another carbohydrate or something more sinister?
Fructose corn syrup, because it's easier.
Okay.
High fructose corn syrup, first of all, it's not high in fructose.
Okay.
It has exactly the same amount of fructose as table sugar. And so you can think of it as liquid table sugar. It's exactly the same. And it's cheap because of farm subsidies of corn, and therefore it was used in many, many, many ingredients. It's gotten a really bad name, in part because of the writings of Michael Pollan, and in part because of people's concerns about too much sugar in the diet. We consume on average about as much high fructose corn syrup as we do table sugar, about 60 pounds each a year, 120 pounds total. That's average use of sugars in the United States. And we would all do better if we ate less sugar. So that's that one. Organics are also a little bit complicated because Organics are very clearly defined. We know exactly what the rules are. They're set by the Department of Agriculture. And to the extent that the rules are followed and farms are inspected to make sure they do, organic farming meets those rules. Those rules are about agricultural production. They're about not using pesticides, chemical pesticides or fertilizers, about not using hormones, antibiotics, genetically modified foods, irradiated foods or sewage sludge in the production of those foods. And organic foods aren't produced without using any of those things. Now, a lot of people think that organic food should do more than that, and that they should be raised sustainably. Right now, sustainability is not a factor in the organic rules. And the organic industry has discovered that what sells organics is not the production values, but the nutrition values, and they are working as hard as they can to demonstrate that organic foods are more nutritious than conventionally produced foods. I think that's a mistake. I think it's going to be very, very difficult to demonstrate a significant difference. And Americans aren't lacking in nutrients anyway. And there's plenty of nutrients in the food supply. So I think that's not a very good political decision, but that's what they're doing, mainly for marketing purposes. But I'm for organics because of the production values.
Okay.
And I'm willing to pay more for organic food because I want my food produced without chemicals and hormones and antibiotics.
Okay, good answer. All right, let's take another caller. Richard, you're on line one. Richard, you with us? He must have dropped off. Let's take Michael. Michael, you're on line one.
Hi there. Yes, regarding enzymes, I understand that papaya enzyme or papain is used as a tenderizer for meats and things like that. So I started taking little slices of dried papaya and putting it on meat when I was eating more meat, and I could see a visible difference in the way it would sort of start breaking down the meat. I'm told that it helps in digesting high fat and meat proteins. And the other question is it true that after infancy we don't have the enzymes to break down dairy products?
Okay.
You know, I had a very hard time hearing his question.
All right. Yeah,
the first one was about papaya used as a meat tenderizer. Sure. Papaya enzyme breaks down protein, and it would do that in meat. But when you eat the papaya enzyme, that protein is inactivated in your stomach and digested in the digestive tract.
Okay.
So it's one thing outside the body, and it's another inside the body.
And the second question was, is it true that adult humans no longer have the enzyme lactose to digest the milk and dairy products, lactose?
Some adults don't, in particularly Asian adults, adults of several ethnic groups don't have that enzyme, and they are lactose intolerant. They usually know it if they really are, because they get sick if they eat anything with lactose in it.
Okay. We have about 4 minutes left. Just to remind both Diane, who's our next caller, and Dr. Nessel. Diane, you're on line one.
Hi. I can't let the discussion of vitamin D go, although that wasn't my main question. I don't discount it. All of our family members are either borderline or very low, particularly the vegetarian. And by taking vitamin D, it's made a big difference. Even with depression. So don't discount it. My primary doctor says she spoke to a doctor from the southeast U.S., and everyone there seems to be low, too, and it's probably because we stay indoors too often. So my main question is on very low carbohydrate dinner diets. A family member, elderly family member, wants to control his diabetes with exceedingly low carbohydrates, and your discussion, well, we need sugar in our diet. Well, I know our body turns everything to glucose, but the brain seems to run mostly on that. So what is that doing to our cells when we take a long-term view of and just eat very low carbs?
Well, I don't know what you mean by very low carbs. Some carbohydrate will be enough to feed the brain, but the real issue in type 2 diabetes is calories, calories from any from any source. And I don't recommend very, very low. I recommend balanced diets. I think they work pretty well for most people.
So we're not doing something to our brain by eliminating most of the carbs from our diet and eating just high.
No, the body compensates for that by breaking down fat and protein and eventually forming something called ketones that the brain can then use in replacement. But that's essentially fooling the body into thinking that you're starving. I don't think that's a healthy way to live. It's not really a good idea.
Well, some of us believe that, but we can't convince Grandpa.
Well,
yeah.
Yes, that's always a problem. Give Grandpa a hug. What can you do?
All right, thank you.
Thanks for your call. All right, so we're coming up in the last minute, and one of the things I kind of like to do is ask my guests to give us some important things to take home, things that we want to make sure we remember here about nutrition in particular.
Well, as I said, my dietary advice is really simple. It's eat less, move more, eat plenty of fruits, vegetables, and grains, and don't eat too much junk food. And most of all, enjoy your food. It's one of life's greatest pleasures, and you should be enjoying it in every meal you have.
And I'm constantly trying to push people to be skeptical. As we've heard today, there's a lot of people who are being apparently believer told that things like enzymes added to their foods may help in some way, when in reality it would be hard to imagine how that product is going to get into your bloodstream to do anything the way your stomach works.
Well, I wish everybody had a better science education, but that's not the way our society works.
All right. Well, I very much appreciate your taking the time. I want to remind our listeners that they can go to our website and get a link to your website, where you do some blogging, and they can ask you questions about things as well. And then we have a couple other websites that should be able to give you reliable information about nutrition.
Yeah, mine is foodpolitics.com.
Okay. Thanks very much. It's been a real pleasure having you join us, and have a good day.
My pleasure.
Good night. Line one is going to return next week, and we're going to be looking at this issue of electronic medical records that the government wants us to spend some money on. What's the benefits? What's the downside? What's the problems? And in particular, we're going to look at what's being done here in Alaska to address the issue of electronic medical records and their promises. We're going to talk with Drs. Jerome List and Dr. Tom Nicewander. Also with us will be Rebecca Madison. So if you're interested in knowing a little bit more about what's good and what's bad and what's possible and what's not possible to be obtained from the use of electronic medical records, we'd ask you to turn in next week. Also, there may be some concerns about confidentiality, and we can certainly address those issues as well. Pat Yak is the Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.